Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 162. It's Monday, May 9th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, the big news this week overall and in public health is the leaked Supreme Court draft decision decimating Roe versus Wade and the constitutional right to abortion. Ironically, this comes just in time for this week's National Women's Health Week. Ugh. Well, as a little bit of history and perhaps a little bit more irony, it was on this date, recording this show on May 9th, in 1960, that the Food and Drug Administration approved the world's first commercially produced birth control pill, which, of course, historians consider one of the major impetuses for the women's rights movement. So the fight continues. I will get to some abortion stories later in the show, but of course, first up, have to talk about COVID-19. It's still alive and well and killing people in America. First up from the Boston Globe, survey finds 4 in 10 American adults know someone who died of COVID-19. With the nation reaching the tragic milestone of 1 million official deaths from the COVID-19 pandemic, 40% of American adults say they know one or more people who have died of the disease, according to a recent survey. Of that 40%, it includes 20% who knew one person who had died from the virus, 13% who knew 2 people, and 7% who said they knew 3 or more people who have died of COVID-19. The survey found that 15% of adults said they had lost a family member, though this could include distant relatives. A different group of researchers has tried to determine how many Americans have lost close relatives to the pandemic. Looking at kinship networks, demographic researchers estimated that for every COVID-19 death, there are 9 bereaved close relatives. And by close relatives, we mean people that have either lost a grandparent, a parent, a sibling, spouse, or child. The deaths have, quote, cast a widening shadow over the population, the researchers said. That level of bereavement is itself a population health concern because bereaved people are at higher risk of mental and physical health issues. The crisis will have long-lasting effects. Even as the mortality ceases, the crisis abates, there will be this lingering imprint on our population. And a quick update on a story that I reported on, the White House Correspondents' Dinner a week ago over the weekend, this from CNN. Journalists from multiple news outlets test positive after White House Correspondents' Dinner weekend. Trevor Noah joked about the evening becoming a super spreader, and now the cases are rolling in. The annual White House Correspondents' Dinner, along with the festivities held in the days before and after it, have led to the inevitable spread of COVID. In the days since the White House Correspondents' Dinner weekend, reporters and staff from CNN, ABC News, NBC News, CBS News, Politico, and other participating news organizations have tested positive for the virus. Well, this is probably nothing really special. This actually isn't particularly special. It's actually normal. It's what we'd expect, the inevitable spread when you get large numbers of people gathered indoors who are unmasked. And even with testing, you're with that many people, it's kind of inevitable that you're going to continue to have spread, especially since these variants and subvariants get increasingly contagious. So what's happening with Americans in the workplace and COVID-19? This from Kaiser Family Foundation, their COVID-19 monitor. With mask mandates being lifted in many places, most workers say they and their coworkers are not regularly wearing masks when indoors at work. Just under 4 in 10, 38% of those who work outside their homes say they wore a mask every time or most of the time when indoors at their place of work in the past 30 days. And 43% say never wore a mask at work in the past 30 days. Black workers at 64% and Hispanic workers at 52% and those with lower incomes, 61%, are more likely than their counterparts to report wearing masks at work at least most of the time. With case rates beginning to rise again in the U.S., around a third of the public think there's currently a new wave of COVID-19 hitting the country, while half say there is not a new wave, and the remainder are not sure. Well, for those folks of you who are not sure out there, there is a wave. Now, how fast it's going to go up, how far it's going to go up, is still a question, but it's definitely happening. And probably more so a danger than what's going to happen to this summer is how it tees us up for next flu season in the fall. White House officials are warning that if we don't get it under control, that we could see a very large COVID-19 death toll next winter for the third winter in a row. Okay, well, in January, I did a deep dive into some of the studies that were looking at Omicron severity. It was touted as being much more mild than previous variants. And you can look in the archives if you want to see that original analysis. But to show that my analysis may not have been that far off mark, this story from Reuters. Omicron as severe as other COVID-19, large U.S. study says. The Omicron variant of the SARS-CoV-2 virus is intrinsically as severe as previous variants, according to a preprint version of a large U.S. study that counters assumptions in other studies that it was more transmissible but less severe. The findings, which estimated Omicron's severity after accounting for the impact of vaccines, should reinforce the importance of inoculations and booster shots, experts said. Vaccines help keep hospitalizations and deaths relatively low during the Omicron surge compared with previous variants. The study is undergoing peer review at Nature Portfolio. We find that the risks of hospitalization and mortality were nearly identical between the Omicron era and times in the past 2 years when different variants were dominant, the researchers said in their report. The new study, based on records of 130,000 COVID patients in Massachusetts, is unique and, quote, pretty strong, said Dr. Arjun Venkatesh of Yale School of Medicine and the Yale Center for Outcomes Research and Evaluation, who was not involved in the research. Rather than just looking at numbers of deaths and hospitalizations, as earlier studies have done, it accounted for patients' vaccination status and medical risk factors and compared similar groups of people, Venkatesh said. So this is the key difficulty in studying this is kind of make it so you're not comparing apples and oranges. You really have to adjust well for vaccination status. So what this means for us is that vaccines do work, but if you're trying to look at the intrinsic dangerousness of these different variants, they don't seem to vary that much. The variance has to do with vaccination status and previous infection status. Each of those additively gives you more protection against severe disease. And to that point, from MedPage Today, CDC says COVID boosters blunted Omicron's effect on nursing homes. An additional booster of COVID vaccine helped substantially reduce the rate of infection in nursing home residents during the Omicron wave compared with the primary series alone, researchers found. Relative vaccine effectiveness of an additional dose of COVID vaccine was 47% in preventing cases among this population, as reported in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. So basically that means you're less than half as likely to get infected if you had the booster, that is the third shot in a shot after the two-shot series, versus just, quote, fully vaccinated. And of course, if you don't get infected, you can't die from it. So that obviously helps, particularly this vulnerable population in nursing homes and long-term care facilities. Okay, well, the U.S. has been flush with vaccines for quite a while here, but this from Stat News. White House documents detail a looming squeeze on COVID-19 boosters. The White House could run out of COVID-19 vaccines if it moves forward with plans to encourage all adults to get a second COVID-19 vaccine booster dose by roughly September 1st, according to a tranche of public documents sent to Congress that had not previously been made public. Although Food and Drug Administration officials have hinted that all American adults may be encouraged to get second boosters this fall, right now, second booster doses are only available to people over the age of 50. The budget documents make it clear that if the administration does want to push second boosters, it will need more money to make it happen. It needs at least 87 million more vaccines for adult boosters and another 5 million more for first boosters for kids. Well, folks, these budget arguments do matter. We may run out of vaccines in this country. Okay, next up, a couple of stories about the devastating effects of COVID-19. This from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. A surveillance study of more than 6,000 women who gave birth in Canada during the pandemic suggests that those infected with COVID-19 were at higher risk for hospitalization and intensive care unit admission than those of non-pregnant women of childbearing age. Infected pregnant women were at significantly increased risk of hospitalization, with a relative risk of 2.65, meaning they had about a 2.7 times greater chance of being hospitalized and having about a 5.5 times greater chance for ICU admission. No patients who had received two or more doses of the COVID-19 vaccine experienced adverse maternal outcomes. Infection, even if mild, was tied to a 60% higher risk of preterm birth. Just more evidence that pregnant people should get the COVID-19 vaccine. And in sort of the roller coaster reporting of COVID's effect on asthma, this from Reuters, COVID worsens asthma in children. Asthma in children may worsen after infection with the coronavirus, doctors warn. They studied nearly 62,000 U.S. children with asthma who had PCR tests for the virus in the first year of the pandemic, including more than 7,700 who tested positive. Infected children had significantly more asthma visits, hospitalizations, emergency inhaler use, and steroid treatments during the 6 months after their illness compared to children who tested negative and compared to their own prior history, researchers reported the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology in Practice. Children who tested negative for the virus had improved asthma control for the next 6 months, meaning fewer emergency department visits and hospitalization for asthma and less asthma treatment. Results of earlier studies show improvement in asthma control in the early part of the pandemic were likely due to public health measures like staying home and masking, which curbed exposure to asthma triggers. Despite the overall impression that children with asthma did well during the first year of the pandemic, the new study shows longer-lasting harm of COVID on children's asthma control. Not actually a surprise. Getting COVID is worse than not getting it. And of course, this is consistent with all kinds of, you know, heart problems and diabetes and kidneys issues, just, you know, a long litany. Okay, well, let's turn to the local COVID-19 update for Lucas County, Ohio. Well, as a little context, national cases continue to go up, and cases have gone up by 50% in the last 2 weeks. So a pretty steady clip there. The Lucas County number of average daily cases over the last week bumped up to 89 per day from 63 from the week before. I must say, though, they're only doing weekly reporting, I think on Wednesdays or Thursdays, so this is actually a little bit old. So as our surveillance systems get weaker, they're not as accurate or timely for giving us information. But one thing we can say for sure is that testing positivity rates, the percent of people that test positive of those that get tested, is going up. The positivity rate jumped up to 10.6% in Lucas County from 7.5% the previous week. In Ohio, it jumped up to 8.5% from 7.7% the previous week. And nationally, jumped up to 8.6% from 6.8%. Now, last week I talked about the fact that in some places testing volume has actually been going down, but that has reversed. And Lucas County saw a big increase in amount of people tested. So some of the lack of clarity before is if positivity rates are going up and the amount of testing is going down, it's a little bit less clear about what the actual the epidemic is doing, the underlying reality. Well, but definitely if you've got increased testing and increased positivity, almost undoubtedly you're seeing a large and rapid rise in actual numbers of cases. And of course, this has all been complicated by the fact that most testing that's done at home, those the results of those never ever get reported to be included in such stats. Well, in nursing homes in Lucas County, we had 14 active cases, which was the same as the previous week, with 9 residents and 5 staff with active COVID-19 cases. And unfortunately, for the first time in almost 2 months, we had another death in a long-term care facility from COVID-19. University of Toledo is ending its year. Unfortunately, they ended on a not such a great note. They had 18 identified cases, which was up from 11 from the week before. And the last couple of weeks, we've seen a tick up in their random surveillance testing, which is a pretty good indicator of what's happening in the entire UT campus community. And they identified 7 people in this random testing, which is 1.7% of those that tested. This is the first time they had it that high in quite a while. So you would expect that University of Toledo, particularly with a lot of young people, would definitely reflect a rising epidemic here locally. Okay, well, cases are one thing, but hospitalization deaths is the ultimate measure of the severity of this pandemic. And hospitalizations in Ohio and the U.S. continue to rise, and looks like they'll be doing that for a while. Deaths nationally are going back up definitely now. It looked like that was leveling off and perhaps reversing, but now it's actually increased. We're having on the order of 350 people die per day of COVID-19 in the U.S. That's where we bottomed out. We didn't even get down under 300. We got down under 200 last summer. At the lull that we had in deaths. But I'll remind folks that this 350 per day is definitely over the pace of reaching 100,000 deaths per year, which is a huge public health problem. This is not just the flu. Well, folks, you are listening to Just for the Health of It on AKT 106.1 FM Toledo. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life, and I am recording this from the John Snow Memorial Studio. Okay, well, next up, I have a very interesting story on the interface between infectious disease vaccinations and cardiovascular disease. This from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Flu vaccination associated with 34% lower risk of cardiac events. A new meta-analysis of 6 randomized controlled trials finds that seasonal influenza vaccination was associated with a 34% lower risk of major adverse cardiovascular events, and people with a recent acute coronary event had a 45% lower risk. The effect sizes reported here for major adverse cardiovascular events and cardiovascular mortality are comparable with, if not greater than, those seen with guideline-recommended mainstays of cardiovascular therapy, such as aspirin, angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, beta blockers, statins, and dual antiplatelet therapy, the authors concluded. So, you have to add to the list for cardiovascular health, get your flu vaccine. It's good for your heart health. Quite amazing. And of course, we've learned this with COVID, but it looks like it's true for the flu as well. Okay, well, let's move on to abortion coverage. I'm going to start with one of my favorite public health news story sites is Your Local Epidemiologist. And she wrote a nice long article here for you epidemiology science freaks of public health. I am just going to give the highlights of her long and detailed analysis. This is: banning abortions will not stop abortions. Abortions are not rare. 1 in 4 women will have an abortion by the time they reach 45 years old. That means that you knew someone who has gotten an abortion, like me. Abortion rates have declined over time. Since the 1990s, the total number of repeated abortions declined 50%. And in 2010, there was another significant push downwards, thanks to the Affordable Care Act and its increased access to birth control. One thing that is evident is that abortions won't stop because laws change. A close to zero change in abortions is consistent with international research. The abortion rate is 37 per 1,000 in countries that prohibit abortion and 34 per 1,000 in countries that allow abortion. With increased desperateness, the rate of illegal and unsafe abortions will start increasing, or people will be forced to have an unwanted pregnancy. Together, this will have immediate impacts on physical and mental health among Americans. Mortality. Women will die. Each year, 7 million women worldwide are admitted to hospitals for unsafe abortions, and 5 to 13% of these women typically die. Morbidity. Women with illegal abortions are at higher risk for serious medical problems, including infections and damage to the genital tract and internal organs due to inserting dangerous objects like sticks, knitting needles, broken glass, etc. Mental illness. Women denied an abortion have higher mental illness and lower well-being. A JAMA study found women denied an abortion reported more anxiety, lower self-esteem, and lower life satisfaction compared to women who were able to get an abortion. No evidence shows that getting an abortion causes negative mental health or well-being outcomes. Economic hardship. A study in the American Journal of Public Health found that women denied an abortion experience an increase in household poverty lasting at least 4 years longer compared to women who receive an abortion. Also, years after an abortion denial, women are more likely to not have enough money to cover basic living expenses like food, housing, and transportation. The National Bureau of Economic Research found denying an abortion lowered a woman's credit score and increased a woman's amount of debt. Violence. Another study found denying abortions kept women in contact with violent partners, putting themselves and their children at risk for physical and emotional harm. Child outcomes. The Turnaway study at the University of California, San Francisco, found that when women have control over the timing of having children, the children benefit. Specifically, they found children born later to women who are able to get an abortion experience more economic security and better maternal bonding than the children born because a woman was denied an abortion. So what's the bottom line? A law will not decrease the number of abortions. It will shift where people get abortions, increase the number of illegal abortions, directly and indirectly impact the health of women, and worsen health disparities in the U.S. We are going backwards, and it will be a public health disaster for decades to come. Okay, so where does the U.S. fit in internationally and globally regarding abortion access? Spoiler alert, not well. This from NPR. U.S. would lag behind global abortion access if Roe v. Wade is undone, advocates say. International rights group warned the U.S. Supreme Court last year that possibly overturning the landmark Roe v. Wade case that made abortions legal in 1973 would put it behind the curve of other nations that have been expanding access to abortion care. Human Rights Watch says there is an international trend toward expanding abortion access. Argentina legalized abortion in 2020, while Mexico decriminalized the procedure in 2021. Statistics also show that in Ecuador, El Salvador, South Africa, and Romania, the more restrictive abortion legislation is, the higher incidences of women dying or contracting diseases after giving birth, according to a September 21 brief submitted to the U.S. Supreme Court. The brief was submitted by Human Rights Watch in partnership with Amnesty International and the Global Justice Center. Consistent with this trend, countries around the world today recognize the health and social risks of restricting abortion and, by extension, the corresponding benefits of expanding abortion access. The organizations say that 60% of women of reproductive age live in countries where abortion is available. Only 26 countries, representing 5% of women of reproductive age, ban or prohibit abortion altogether. The brief also argues that among the 36 countries the United Nations classifies as economically developed, including the U.S., 34 of those 36 make abortions accessible. Furthermore, the organization says the U.S. has signed several international treaties, such as a Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and the UN's International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Included in these treaties are the rights to non-discrimination, the right to be free from torture and other cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment or punishment, the right to privacy, sound familiar, and the right to life, the brief says. The human rights organizations argue that by restricting access to abortions, women will seek out unsafe and unsanitary procedures and be more susceptible to death or disease, thereby jeopardizing their right to life. Countries that have ratified a treaty are therefore legally obligated to uphold the principles embodied in that treaty. International committees such as the UN Human Rights Committee enforce treaties. The UN has said its International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights should not introduce new barriers to abortion and should remove existing barriers that deny effective access by women and girls to safe and legal abortion. So much for the United States being a global leader in all that is well and good. Okay, next up, I want to cover what I think may be the real inflection point, a pivot point for how this battle over abortion rights goes. This from Associated Press. Next battle over access to abortion will focus on pills. It took two trips over state lines, navigating icy roads and a patchwork of state laws for a 32-year-old South Dakota woman to get abortion pills last year. For abortion seekers like her, such journeys, along with the pills sent through mail, will grow in importance if the Supreme Court follows through with its leaked draft opinion that would overturn the landmark Roe v. Wade decision and allow individual states to ban the procedure. The woman, who spoke on the condition of anonymity because she was concerned for her family's safety, said the abortion pills allow her to end an unexpected and high-risk pregnancy and remain devoted to her two children. But anti-abortion activists and politicians say these cross-border trips, remote doctor's consultations, and pill deliveries are what they will try to stop next. Medication abortion will be where access to abortion is decided, said Mary Ziegler, a professor at Florida State University College of Law who specializes in reproductive rights. That's going to be the battleground that decides how enforceable abortion bans are. Use of abortion pills has been rising in the U.S. since 2000, when the Food and Drug Administration approved mifepristone, the main drug used in medication abortions. More than half of U.S. abortions are now done with pills rather than surgery, according to the Guttmacher Institute, a research group that supports abortion rights. Two drugs are required. The first, mifepristone, blocks a hormone needed to maintain a pregnancy. A second drug, misoprostol, taken 1 to 2 days later, empties the uterus. Both drugs are available as generics and are also used to treat other conditions. The FDA last year lifted a long-standing requirement that women pick up abortion pills in person. Federal regulations now also allow mail delivery nationwide. Even so, 19 states have passed laws requiring a medical clinician to be physically present when abortion pills are administered to a patient. South Dakota is among them, joining several states, including Texas, Kentucky, Arkansas, Ohio, Tennessee, and Oklahoma, where Republicans have moved to further restrict access to abortion pills in recent months. These moves have spurred online services that offer information on getting abortion pills and consultations to get a prescription. After the woman in South Dakota found that the state's only abortion clinic could not schedule her in time for a medication abortion, she found an online service called Just the Pill that advised her to drive across to Minnesota for a phone consultation with a doctor. A week later, she came back to Minnesota for the pills. Besides crossing state lines, women can also turn to international online pharmacies, says Greer Donnelly, a professor specializing in reproductive health care at the University of Pittsburgh Law School. Some women also are having prescribed pills forward through states without restrictions. It allows for someone to have an abortion without a direct role of a provider. It's going to be much harder for states to control abortion access, she said, adding, the question is, how is it going to be enforced? Abortion law experts say it's an unsettled question whether states can restrict access to abortion pills in the wake of the FDA's decision. The general rule is that federal law preempts conflicting state law, said Laura Hermer, a professor at the Mitchell Hamline School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. There's no question that the FDA has proper authority to regulate the drugs used in medication abortions. The question is whether a state can make a viable winning argument that, for public health purposes, it needs to further regulate access to the relevant medications. Hermer said she doesn't think there is a valid public health reason because the published evidence is that the drugs are exceptionally safe. But if the Supreme Court overrules Roe v. Wade and states give embryos and fetuses full rights as people, then all bets are off. The Planned Parenthood regional organization that includes South Dakota doesn't believe it can legally mail abortion pills to patients there. Telemedicine providers have to abide by the laws of the state where the patient is, said Dr. Sarah Traxler, chief medical officer for Planned Parenthood North Central States in St. Paul. She acknowledged that some organizations disagree, but she added, "We don't feel like we have the liberty to mail pills from Minnesota to other places in the country where it's illegal to provide medication abortion." Sue Liebel, the state policy director for Susan B. Anthony List, a prominent organization opposed to abortion, acknowledged that medication abortions have crept up on Republican state lawmakers. "This is a new frontier, and states are grappling with enforcement mechanisms," she added, saying that the advice that I always give, if you shut the front door, the pills are going to come in the back door. Liebel maintained women should not be prosecuted for seeking abortions, keeping with a long-standing principle of many abortion opponents. She suggested the next target for state enforcement should be the pharmacies, organizations, and clinics that provide the abortion pills. She also said abortion rights opponents should focus on electing a presidential candidate who would work to reverse the FDA's decision. The FDA said a scientific review supporting broadening access to the drugs and found complications were rare. The agency has reported 26 deaths associated with the drug since 2000, though not all of those can be directly attributed to the medication due to existing health problems and other factors. However, the new legal battles on the horizon and abortion seekers going to greater lengths to obtain the procedure, Donnelly, the law professor, worried that state lawmakers will turn their attention toward the women who get the pills. Indeed, a Louisiana House committee advanced a bill last Wednesday that would make abortion a crime of homicide for which a woman ending her pregnancy could be charged, along with anyone helping her. Many anti-abortion legislators might realize the only way to enforce these laws is to prosecute the pregnant person themselves. Well, folks, my own personal opinion, it's going to get really ugly before it gets better over a long haul. And in the meantime, this from Associated Press. With abortion in jeopardy, minority women have the most to lose. If you are black or Hispanic in a conservative state that already limits access to abortions, you are far more likely than a white woman to have one. And if the U.S. Supreme Court allows states to further restrict or even ban abortions, minority women who already face limited access to health care will bear the brunt of it, according to statistics analyzed by the Associated Press. When it comes to the effect on minority women, the numbers are unambiguous. In Mississippi, people of color comprise 44% of the population, but are 81% of women receiving abortions, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, which tracks health statistics. In Texas, they're 59% of the population and 74% of those receiving abortions. The numbers in Alabama are 35% and 69%. In Louisiana, people of color represent 42% of the population and about 72% of those receiving abortions. Abortion restrictions are racist, said Kathy Torres, an organizing manager with Frontera Fund, a Texas organization that helps women pay for abortions. They directly impact people of color, black, brown, indigenous people, people who are just trying to make ends meet. Why the great disparities? Lori Bertram Roberts, executive director of the Alabama-based Yellowhammer Fund, which provides financial support for women seeking abortion, said women of color in states with restrictive abortion laws often have limited access to health care and a lack of choices for effective birth control. Schools often have ineffective or inadequate sex education. If abortions are outlawed, those same women, often poor, will likely have the hardest time traveling to distant parts of the country to terminate pregnancies or raising children they might struggle to afford, said Roberts, who is black and once volunteered at Mississippi's only abortion clinic. We're talking about folks who are already marginalized. Torres said historically anti-abortion laws have been crafted in ways that hurt low-income women. She pointed to the Hyde Amendment, a 1980 law that prevents the use of federal funds to pay for abortions except in rare cases. And I will add that Medicaid provides funding for a huge amount of pregnancies. I forget the exact things, but something on the order of like 40% of pregnancies in this country. I'll have to double check and get an accurate number of that in a future episode. She pointed out the Hyde Amendment, a 1980 law that prevents the use of federal law funds to pay for abortions except in rare cases. She also cited the 2021 Texas law that bans abortions after around 6 weeks of pregnancy. Where she lives, near the U.S.-Mexico border in the Rio Grande Valley, women are forced to travel to obtain abortions and must pass in-state border patrol checkpoints where they have to disclose their citizen status, she said. Regardless of what legislators say, Torres insisted, the intent is to target women of color to control their bodies. They know those whose restrictions are going to affect. They know that, but they don't care. Across the country, U.S. Census Bureau information analyzed by the Associated Press shows fewer black and Hispanic women have health insurance, especially in states with tight abortion restrictions. For example, in Texas, Mississippi, and Georgia, at least 16% of black women and 36% of Latinas were uninsured in 2019, some of the highest such rates in the country. Problems are compounded in states without effective education programs about reproduction. Mississippi law says sex education in public schools must emphasize abstinence and avoid pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases. Discussion of abortion is forbidden, and instructors may not demonstrate how to use condoms or other contraception. Okay, well, moving on to contraception access, which of course is a foundation of family planning. This from Medical Express. Family planning. Research singles out the omission that might kill 27,000 people per year. This is globally. Restricting U.S. foreign aid for non-governmental organizations that provide information on or access to abortion-related services in developing countries may have harmful effects on maternal and child mortality and HIV incident rates on the same scale as an ongoing civil conflict. In a paper published in PNAS, Karim Khan Kavlaki of Bocconi University in Milan and Valentina Rotondi of the University of Oxford investigate the effects of the so-called Mexico City policy. Since its inception in 1985, the Mexico City policy withdraws U.S. funding, federal funding for non-governmental organizations that provide information on or access to abortion around the world. The Mexico City policy is enforced and rescinded along partisan lines. It is one of the first policies implemented or continued by every Republican president and lifted by every Democratic president, usually in the first weeks of a new administration. Previous studies have analyzed abortion rates under the Mexico City policy and found that when that policy is in place, the number of pregnancies and abortions increases. Kavlaki and Rotondi study the link between the Mexico City policy and a broad set of health outcomes. Using country-level data from 134 countries between 1990 and 2015, they found the Mexico City policy to be associated with higher maternal mortality, child mortality, and HIV incidence rates. Furthermore, the effects are magnified by dependency on U.S. aid and mitigated by aid from non-U.S. donors whose support is unaffected by the Mexico City policy. For a subsample of 38 countries with populations over 900 million total, highly dependent on U.S. aid, the effects imply between 1 and 4% increase in maternal and child mortality and HIV incidence rates. Such figures are comparable to the effect of an ongoing civil conflict in a country. In absolute numbers, the estimates imply that reinstating the Mexico City policy between 2017 and 2021 increased the number of maternal and child deaths in these 38 countries by about 27,000 per year, for a total of about 108,000 over the four-year term, and the number of new infections by about 90,000 per year, or 360,000 over the 4 years. They found that the Mexico City policy disrupts the provision of family planning services in affected countries and is thus associated with women having significantly less direct access to in-person family planning programs and in-person AIDS-related information. Furthermore, when the Mexico City policy is in place, women are less likely to declare that they are using modern contraceptive methods, and pregnant women are more likely to report their pregnancy is not desired. Newborns are less likely to be tested for HIV as part of their antenatal care, and their mothers are less likely to receive health support from professional health staff after delivery. We conclude that by restricting access to family planning programs, the Mexico City policy makes it harder for people to get information and support on sexual and reproductive health, which results in higher maternal and child mortality, as well as HIV incidents around the globe. Okay, folks, well, this is a really an example of a larger point that, as in with economic development, that women's economic development is the most powerful predictor of overall economic development, and this is tightly related to human rights for women. As this story shows, reproductive rights also are determinative of a lot of the health status of a population. Women are both the recipients and the caregivers of very much health care. And if we don't protect women's health rights, we all lose. Okay, well, let's sprinkle in a teeny bit of good news. This from the Health and Human Services Department. The Department of Health and Human Services launches a new maternal mental health hotline, a gift for Mother's Day. The U.S. Health and Human Service Department announced the launch of the Maternal Mental Health Hotline, a new confidential toll-free hotline for expecting and new moms experiencing mental health challenges. Those who contact the hotline can receive a range of support, including brief interventions from trained counselors who are culturally and trauma-informed, as well as referrals to both community-based and telehealth providers as needed. Callers also receive evidence-based information and referrals to support groups and other community resources. The hotline creates a safe space for expecting and new moms who are experiencing maternal depression, anxiety, or other mental health concerns to have confidential conversations and get the support they need. Moms can call or text 1-833-9-HELP-4-MOMS and connect with their counselor at no charge. Again, that's 1-833-9-HELP-4-MOMS, and the 4 is the letter 4, not spelled out. Again, 1-833-9-HELP-4-MOMS. The Maternal Mental Health Hotline is not intended as an emergency response line, and individuals in behavioral health crisis should continue to talk to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-TALK. Okay, well, next up is a story that highlights the fight for truth, that is data-based, evidence-based public health and public policy. This from the Miami Herald. The Sunshine State goes dark on adolescent health. It's a dangerous misstep in Florida. The Sunshine State is forcing adolescent health into the shadows, and the consequences could be far-reaching. The Florida Department of Education recently and quietly ended its decades-long participation in the Youth Risk Behavioral Survey. A nationwide survey of high school students sponsored by the CDC, abruptly ending Florida survey participation after 30 years, means that critically important data needed to support adolescents' health in Florida and nationwide will no longer be available. The need for such data is currently more vital than ever, and the timing of this withdrawal raises serious additional concerns. Adolescents across Florida are still dealing with COVID-related hardships that directly affect their mental and physical well-being. In addition, Florida is proposing and passing bills like the so-called Don't Say Gay bill, as well as legislation to weaken firearm safety laws. Decades of research tell us that these bills can directly harm adolescent health, though the proponents of these bills claim, erroneously and without scientifically based evidence, that they are necessary for adolescents' well-being. And yet, rather than politicians proving their point by letting the Youth Behavior Risk Factor Survey continue to track relevant data, they are shutting it down. Better to not have your narrative challenged by evidence. About 85,000 high school students in 44 states, including almost 6,000 from Florida, participated in the most recent survey conducted in 2019. That survey, like others before it, provided a wealth of critical information regarding adolescents' health needs and behaviors, like mental health, substance use, sexual activity and experiences with violence and bullying, and like other state surveys conducted over the past several decades, this youth survey is essential for tracking the health and well-being of adolescents. In turn, these data offer important insights and trends that inform school and statewide programs, policies, and funding. States' commitment to this youth survey reflect a shared concern for adolescent health and a shared understanding of the need for data to support evidence-informed approaches regardless of political agendas. Florida's withdrawal from this youth survey will eliminate the data needed to promote adolescents' physical and mental health in the state. Withdrawing the third most populous state from the survey will also lessen our understanding of national trends. The youth survey is a critical data source relevant to all youth. Even though public attention often focuses on data trends, legislation and programs that target marginalized populations, such as LGBTQ and racial and ethnic minority youth, or politically contentious issues such as firearms and gender identity. And while focusing on marginalized population and contentious issues is imperative, without the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, the Florida Department of Health and other state agencies lose a key tool for tracking other important youth behaviors, such as nutrition, contraception, mental health, smoking and marijuana use, and school safety. For example, the Youth Survey documents how school safety issues are particularly problematic in Florida. 15% of all students report that they skip school because they feel unsafe in Florida, which is 66% higher than the national average of 9%. 15% in Florida, 9% nationally. Florida schools have been particularly unsafe for many students, including LGBTQ students, long before the passage of the Don't Say Gay bill. Because of the survey, we know that about 15% of Florida's high school students identified as LGBT in 2019. Compared to their heterosexual and cisgender peers, LGBTQ students report much higher rates of bullying, being threatened with a weapon, and skipping school due to feeling unsafe. They were also at least twice as likely to report feeling sad or hopeless, or to have seriously considered suicide. The passage of the Don't Say Gay bill and loosened gun restrictions may affect young people's safety and mental health, including in their homes, schools, and communities. But without the survey, we won't be able to track any of these trends. We join others in calling for Florida to continue administering this youth survey and urge other states to avoid this dangerous misstep. Ignoring adolescents' behaviors doesn't mean they don't happen. It just means we will lack information that is imperative to support their healthy development. The Youth Risk Behavior Survey shines a needed light on adolescents' experiences and motivates policies and programs that meet their needs, which cannot happen if politically motivated decisions keep them in the shadows. Okay, going to switch gears here. Go big, go globally. This from the Associated Press. United Nations says record number of people without enough to eat in 2021. The United Nations said last Wednesday that the number of people without enough to eat on a daily basis reached all-time high last year as it poised to hit appalling new levels as the Ukraine war affects global food production. About 193 million people in 53 countries suffered acute food insecurity in 2021 due to what the UN said was a toxic triple combination of conflict, weather extremes, and economic effects of the coronavirus pandemic. The UN said the total number of people without adequate food every day increased by 40 million last year, confirming a worrisome trend of annual increases over several years. The figures appeared in the Global Report on Food Crisis, which is produced jointly by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Food Program and the European Union. Countries experiencing protracted conflicts, including Afghanistan, Congo, Ethiopia, Nigeria, South Sudan, Syria, and Yemen, had the most food insecure populations. The report forecasts that Somalia will face one of the world's worst food crises in 2022 due to prolonged drought, increasing food prices, and persistent violence. The various factors could lead 6 million Somalis into acute food crisis. The war in Ukraine poses further risks for Somalia and many other African countries that rely on Ukraine and Russia for wheat, fertilizer, and other food supplies. The World Food Program's chief economist, Arif Hussan, said the UN Food Agency projects that an additional 47 million people will become food insecure in a crisis or worse situation because of the war in Ukraine as a result of higher food and fuel prices and inflation. Even before the war, people were dealing with the consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic and reduced incomes, and food prices were at a 10-year high and fuel prices were at a 7-year high. The percentage of the population analyzed in the report who are in acute food insecurity has gone up from just over 11% in 2016 to just over 22% in 2021. Yikes, doubling in 5 years. At the same time, funding to help them has dropped, which is a huge concern. In 2021, $8 billion was available for emergency work, a 25% drop from 2017. The report called for greater investment in agriculture and appealed for $1.5 billion to help farmers in at-risk regions with the upcoming planting season to help stabilize and increase local food production. The message to rich nations in the G7 and G20 is that food insecurity and hunger around the world are exploding. And if we don't address these issues, we end up paying, frankly, 1,000 times more just a few years down the road. The world has seen this happen with the Syrian war and the outpouring to Europe, with Afghanistan and the Central Americans and Haitians trying to enter the U.S. We need to put the same energy collectively that we put into addressing the COVID-19 pandemic into addressing acute hunger. It's about political will and focus. I would add that we need to put more energy than we've put into COVID-19, but that's true for many public health issues, and certainly inadequate food is one of the most basic public health threats there can be. Okay, well, next up, I want to do an important update. This from Stat News. Alzheimer's drug company admits defeat. Biogen's announcement that it is, quote, substantially eliminating its spending on Aduhelm caps, a remarkable story of development gone bad. In a controversial move in June 2021, the FDA approved the Alzheimer's drug, disregarding the strong objections of a panel of independent experts that said the science didn't support approving the drug. In early April of this year, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services announced it would cover the cost of Aduhelm only for patients enrolled in clinical trials supported by the center, or the FDA, or the National Institutes of Health. That decision was scientifically based and politically courageous. The drug is clinically ineffective, unsafe, and expensive. So by Biogen saying they're going to substantially eliminating, I assume that just means that they're going to make enough drugs to actually allow for these clinical trials. But the idea that they're going to have, this is going to be some huge boon, which of course it wasn't scientifically proven it would do anything, let alone a boon for folks with mild Alzheimer's. Hopefully this is the end to this tragic story, a remarkable story of drug development gone bad. Okay, well, yet another negative effect of the kind of regressive political environment we've been living in. This from Science Daily. Affirmative action bans had, quote, devastating impact on diversity in medical schools, study finds. New UCLA-led research finds that in states with bans on affirmative action programs, the proportion of students from underrepresented racial and ethnic minority groups in U.S. public medical schools fell by more than one-third by 5 years after those bans went into effect. And we know this is not good for the overall healthcare and public health of this country. And in a truly frightening story, this from NBC News. Almost half of LGBTQ youth seriously considered suicide in the past year. Nearly half of LGBTQ youths in the United States have seriously considered suicide in the past year, a survey last Wednesday found, piling onto concerns for a vulnerable group of adolescents amid a nationwide culture war over LGBTQ issues. While the Trevor Project only surveyed LGBTQ youth for its latest report, the National Institute of Mental Health estimates that of Americans age 18 to 25, 11% have had serious suicidal thoughts. Whew! So that's about five times as much among LGBTQ youth. The survey findings come amid a historic legislative push by state lawmakers across the country to limit the rights of LGBTQ people, particularly transgender minors. From January 1st to March 15th, state legislators proposed a record 238 bills that would limit the rights of LGBTQ people, or more than three a day, about half targeting transgender people specifically, according to an NBC News analysis of data from the American Civil Liberty Union and the LGBTQ advocacy group Freedom for All Americans. The survey revealed that 93% of transgender and non-binary respondents said they are worried about being denied access to gender-affirming care. 91% said they were worried about being denied access to the bathroom, and 83% said they were worried about being denied the ability to play sports because of state or local laws. Despite the harrowing rates of mental health issues plaguing LGBTQ youths, 80% of respondents who said they wanted treatment for mental health issues, or 60% of all respondents, said that they could not receive it in the last year. Youth surveyed cited fears of discussing mental health issues, fears of not being taken seriously, and concerns with obtaining parental permission as the top obstacles to receiving care. Not everything is doom and gloom, as data shows that LGBTQ youths who live in an affirming environment reported significantly lower rates of suicide attempts. Respondents who were accepted for their LGBTQ identities at home were about one-third less likely to have attempted suicide in the past year. That's 10% versus 16%. While those who were accepted at school were about one quarter less likely, 13% versus 17%. The survey also laid out LGBTQ youth's recommendations for how parents can make their queer children feel supported. The most commonly cited actions included using their children's pronouns correctly, educating themselves about LGBTQ history, and being welcoming to their children's LGBTQ friends or partners. There's something that everyone can do. Having that affirmation and support from others is highly protective of LGBTQ youth. Let's make it so. Okay, well, not a lot of great news this week, but want to end with something a little more positive. This from WebMD. 1 week social media break reduces anxiety and depression. Taking a week-long break from social media can lower feelings of anxiety and depression, according to a new study published in the journal Cyberpsychology, Behavior, and Social Networking. People who stopped using platforms such as TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook for 7 days reported an increased sense of well-being, and some said they freed up about 9 hours in their week that they would have spent scrolling. Participants who took a break were more likely to agree with well-being statements such as, "I've been feeling optimistic about the future," and "I've been thinking clearly." They were also less likely to feel nervous, worried, or report depressive symptoms. So, if you need a little mental health break, consider taking a little sabbatical from social media. Okay, well, now we're to the bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I report on in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list. 13 this week. First up, sweeping, limited, or no powers at all. What's at stake in the mask mandate appeal? 2, can COVID lead to impotence? Yeah. You want to know. This is totally consistent with its effect on the cardiovascular system. 3, as overdoses soar, more states decriminalize fentanyl testing strips. That's good news. 4, a pediatrician's point of view, anti-abortion is anti-child. 5, what the Supreme Court should know about abortion care. This is an editorial from Scientific American. 6, abortion pill provider sees spike in U.S. interest after SCOTUS leak. 7. Abortion pills by mail pose challenge for officials in red states. 8. Corporate America doesn't want to talk abortion, but it may have to. And 9. For you activist folks, how to win the abortion argument. Activists overseas have lessons for post-Roe America. And 10. One that's been going on for many decades. I remember back in the 80s this being a huge issue. World Health Organization reveals shocking extent of exploitative formula milk marketing. This is something all across the world, but particularly in third world countries, a problem that interferes with women breastfeeding when possible. 11, two-thirds of working parents are burned out. Here's how to spot the signs and get help. Check it out. 12, Medicare surprise. Drug plan prices touted during open enrollment can rise within a month. And unfortunately, you can't change your plan after that month. You might have gotten it because of the drug prices, but they can change it anytime they want. And last but not least, 13, Medicare beneficiaries need more help navigating the program. This is especially true since the Medicare Advantage programs, hugely complicated and problematic, are becoming more and more common. You can listen to these and all the stories covered on this episode at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.